Hello, and welcome to the White House Correspondents Insider Series, Cone of Silence, because some things are meant to be overheard. With me tonight is one of the funniest, hardworking showrunners in Hollywood, writer, producer, director, and my friend and former boss, Dave Mandel, the executive producer of Veep, Curb Your Enthusiasm, a veteran of Seinfeld, and SNL. As some of you know, I was a consultant on Veep. Dave took the reins as Veep executive producer and showrunner for season 5 and had the daunting task of wrapping up the show at the end of its 7th season in the spring of 2019. With a new deal at HBO, we'll see plenty more of Dave. We want to get into that, look back at his impressive career, and so much more. Dave, it's so good to talk to you. On behalf of everyone in Washington, thank you for this amazing season.
You're welcome. By the way, I don't think I ever considered myself your boss, ever.
Oh, well, that's good. I love that. I like to hear that. It has been a really fun relationship. We'll get into that, but we've got to talk about this season because everyone in Washington is still talking about it. How do you come back? Julia was ill. Thank God she's okay. You had the whole season pretty much done, right? And then what did you do? Did you rewrite? Can you take us inside that?
We had it very much mapped out. This would have been 2017. We had it mapped out, and obviously Trump was in the White House, and we knew that. And we had it sort of mapped out. It was very similar in the sense of, it was Veep. She was definitely, still doing the same thing. She was going to be trying to get the presidency. We were, in Iowa. There was going to be a debate. We had all the same things were kind of happening. And as we were working on it, I guess I had a little bit of a gnawing thing in the back of my head, which is, just a little bit of how is this going to play, a year from now when it airs? How's this going to play? What's going to be going on in the world? It was ever so slightly bothering me because you could you could feel that politics was changing so much. You were very aware of that, but I didn't necessarily know how to voice it. I didn't know what to do with it. When Julia got cancer, which was obviously a horrible thing, the one good thing about it was we ended up shutting down for a while she recovered. And during that shutdown period, Trump entered the second full year of his presidency. And we sort of like to joke in the show that if you were sort of paying attention in that sort of January, February, March, he really started to kind of sow his oats. Like he started to feel really comfortable in the job, and it got crazier and crazier. If you look back at those couple of months, it's like the lies got, there were more lies per day, more crazy tweets. And while the show takes no side and is sort of very agnostic about parties, I myself am, quite liberal and constantly getting that much more liberal. At no point did we ever want to make the show pick a side, but at the same time, as Trump got worse and worse, and it wasn't just Trump, it just seemed like people were getting elected all over the world that just started to lean more towards, this almost kind of supreme leader kind of feeling all over the world, the Philippines, Italy, Brazil, all these places. Everything started to feel darker, and I started to sort of feel like Veep isn't reflecting this darkness, but also a lot of what Veep was doing started to feel irrelevant. And so it was sort of during that period that I sort of realized we have to kind of repaint not just Selena, but really the world with this, darker paintbrush. Because so much of what the show had been was Selena messes up and pays a price, at the end of the episode. And all of a sudden in our real world, people were messing up. Trump was saying things that would have destroyed any other politician, and yet nobody was paying a price. People were getting away with things left and right. And I guess we just started painting things with a darker paintbrush and really just started sort of embracing the darkness, because the only way to kind of show what was going on was to make these characters, to make the situations, dare I say, more bleak. And so that was the process. And it was really was almost like reinventing the show because so much of what, as I said, what the show was changed. It just, it had to.
So do you look at it character by character? I mean, do you look at it and say, I want Selena to end up here and I want Jonah to end up there? I mean, how do you make those decisions?
I mean, the world revolves around Selena. And when I go into a season, I like to know sort of where am I starting and where am I where I'm ending. And in my original sort of version of what became the final season, I knew we were going to be starting, you know, oddly enough, we had been told this wonderful story by Tommy Vitor from the Obama campaign, who's now one of the Pod Saves America guys. And I've credited him with this. He told us a story about Obama landing at the wrong airport. And the second we heard that story, I knew that was the opening scene of the season. Selena Rent lands at the wrong airport in Iowa, and we're off to the races. We're back to Veep. And a lot of that first episode of Veep also was very influenced by the Shattered book by Amy Parnes and John Allen. And they had come into the show and they had kind of spent some time with us and had become friends. And so we definitely knew that sort of like there were definitely going to be this idea of, you know, everything is sort of the same as it always was with her and her campaign. And the more she tries to do it right, the more things go wrong. So there's your start. But the original ending was that she was going to be at the convention. You know, she's in play for the presidency. It's a brokered convention. She was going to try and offer Jonah the vice presidency. And Jonah was going to mess her up. And in the end, she would lose. Probably Tom James would become the president. Because of Jonah, she suffered. And we would then jump ahead to the future, and we would see her eventually become vice president again, and then we would see her die and see that sort of history had forgotten her. So a lot of the things are the same, but the big difference is, again, this idea of Jonah screwing her up and her losing the presidency. And then, as I said, I started to think to myself, why is she the only one losing? Why is she the only one on Earth doing bad things but paying a price? Because it just seems like the bad guys are winning. And so, with that in mind, very quickly it changed to this idea of, like, what's the worst thing you can imagine? Well, she does lots of bad things, wins the presidency, does the worst thing you can imagine, which we sort of filled in the hole, which was she betrays Gary. And then you end up with America with Selena Meyer as the president and Jonah as the vice president. And it just, as the, when those things sort of fell into place, it just sort of felt like, oh my God, that's frightening and horrible and hilarious. And maybe, hopefully, you know, has a bit of commentary on sort of what's going on these days, which is, you know, why does it seem like the bad people are winning? And so once those things lock in, the other characters kind of, you know, sort of revolve around that bigger, I guess, spine. That becomes the spine. But, you know, all through the season, things just got darker. So the first episode, which was written by Lou Morton, who you know, always had the idea of Selena acting sort of callously towards, you know, a mass shooting, you know, a school shooting or whatever, and kind of, you know, sort of pointing out sort of the same old thoughts and prayers thing. And that existed before Julia had cancer. And then during the, you know, year and change it took us to get going again, you know, there were like six more shootings. I'm sure I'm actually underestimating.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, this idea became, well, why are we, I mean, I hate to say it, why are we stopping with one shooting? Isn't the and I say funnier, and I don't mean funny that school shootings are funny. I mean her indifference and politicians' inability to solve this crisis is sadly what's funny. And how do we, you know, satirize that? Well, let's just keep having so many shootings, it gets almost ridiculous. And so now there are three shootings in there, and one of them actually ends up, for lack of a better word, saving her announcement and allowing good things to happen to her. And so, you know, that's dark. And I admit that that's really dark. And it's supposed to
be. It's so bad that it's good.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And again, just because I don't ever want people to misunderstand, the shootings themselves are not what's funny. There's nothing funny about it. What's funny, sadly, is our inability to do anything about it all these years later. So that, you know, that's the point we're trying to make.
You know, it's funny you should describe all this so willingly. We were talking about the fact that it's you, Shonda Rhimes, Ryan Murphy are the most famous showrunners, and that you are so willing to explain.
They may be in a higher category, but thank you.
No, it's true. But that you're willing to take people inside the process and really explain what you did. I don't know if that's brave or, I mean, people really enjoy it and you've been willing to share it. You haven't gotten any blowback on that, have you?
No, I mean, sometimes obviously people misunderstand things. And if someone doesn't find something, you know, if someone's offended, you know, it's hard to convince them not to be offended, I'll simply say.
Well, but last season you offended everyone, right?
You offended everyone.
I'm not talking about what you're saying, but the show did, which was wonderful.
We always offend everyone. And yet some people sort of like put their blinders on and go, but you said this one thing. And it's like, yeah, we said that one thing, but we also said this, this, and this, and this, and this. We're not taking any prisoners. That's the attitude of the show. In terms of explaining stuff, I guess what I'll sort of say is, number one, as a former, I guess, you know, once upon a time, I was, you know, a writer that, you know, was sort of, you know, new to my career and whatnot. You know, I devoured, you know, any kind of, you know, interview, magazine. I used to love, you know, DVD commentaries and all that kind of stuff. So just in sense, when I think about, like, sort of the young writers out there, I love talking about the process, how we write the show, how we come up with these things, because I figure, well, maybe it'll inspire someone, maybe it'll help somebody, you know, figure out their own script. And then the honest answer I guess I'm proud of it. I don't know how else to put it. You know, it's like I'm happy to talk about the show because I'm really, really proud of it. And so I'm more than happy to kind of, you know, share what I think was the, you know, the right process and why we did what we did. So, you know, it's sort of, again, it comes from a place of pride.
Well, the other thing you touched on it is so many people came into the writer's room and you were so willing to listen to what professionals had to say. And all you need to do is ask anyone in Washington about what they do and they'll talk endlessly. But there were some folks like Mitt Romney and Ann Romney came in. Can you talk about when they came in to talk to you?
Yeah, I mean, let me just preface it by saying, I think the show going back and, you know, you were around before me, you know, going back to, you know, Armando Iannucci created the show and then I took over in season 5, as you said, the show always sort of, you know, spent time in D.C., met people and whatnot. And really, I think the currency of the show was the reality of Washington. And so I guess I'll just say philosophically, when I took over, I carried that forward and any real thing was always just gold for us in the sense of if a turn of phrase, you know, some little fact about, you know, I don't know, the upstairs building in one of the house office buildings, you know, things like that. And so all of that stuff, whether it was getting our production designer to have access somewhere, getting, you know, I remember you helped us arrange like a really wonderful backstage tour at the Reagan Library when Selena was trying to build her library. All of that kind of stuff, you know, both made the show seem realer and also inspired us. And so when Romney came, that was before season 6. And so we knew we were going into a season where Selena had lost the presidency. And obviously at the time, Romney had lost the presidency.
And it's always good to remind a presidential candidate that they lost.
But you know what? He was kind of great about it. And that's what made it such a really wonderful day. I mean, number one, they were a really interesting couple. And I felt like, you know, just sitting down with them. And again, they came into our writer's room. All the writers are there. Julia's there. You know, I think we bring in a lunch, whatever. But, you know, spending the time and kind of getting to know them, number one, we picked up all these really interesting little phrases and stuff. So, you know, at one point or another, Mitt was telling a story. Mitt, like, I'm his good friend.
Right.
Senator Romney was telling a story about, like, I think some kind of, like, early scandal that had happened back when he was in the governor's mansion in Massachusetts, something with, I don't know, landscapers or gardeners or something. And it was a whole thing. But as he put it, and he said this phrase, he said, if you're explaining, you're losing. And, you know, that's one of those things where we all just wrote it down because right. It just, oh, my God. And then we had Selena say that. And now that's not a scene unto itself. But just getting those words out of her mouth and other things like that just you know, again, I think it just makes the fabric of the show that much more believable in that, and it plays to that thing where people in DC really, it resonates with them because, you know, it's like, oh, I've heard that before. And then for regular folks that aren't in DC, boy, it sounds really good when you hear something like that. But what we, the real thing that we got out of him that I loved was he was willing to talk about his loss. And obviously with him, or maybe not obviously, he talks a lot about, you know, his family. Obviously, he has all the children. He has so many grandchildren. And how much he really sort of found comfort in that. They both really did. And what was great was hearing him talk about the support system he had really made us realize Selena has none of that. And that basically none of the things that sustained him through the loss exist for Selena Meyer. And so it really kind of led to, you know, sort of her sort of stay in the nut house and how brittle she was and really how not over the loss she was, because she's not a normal person like he is that has, you know, this system. So you get things like that by just, you know, by talking. And it's not us saying to him, hey, tell us something funny. It's actually when a couple of times people have come in and quote unquote tried to be funny, it's the worst. It's when they tell us about their day, their job, somewhere they've been, we ask a question that we get, you know, just pure gold. Because I can remember years ago, meeting with both Anita McBride, who was one of our advisors, and also I can't remember if it was Anita or you, and forgive me, who put us in touch with former Congresswoman and Assistant Secretary of State Ellen
Tauscher.
Tauscher, who has now since sadly passed away. And she was fantastic and, you know, talked to us a lot about, and she and Anita both talked to us about, you know, the gift giving that you have to do in these sort of like sort of hard situations. And all, and again, just the reality of the stories they had led to us kind of building the whole thing with the Chinese and the gift giving and the negotiations.
And you kept bringing the gift back. That's what was great. Yes. The gift giving back. But it was so delicious.
And, you know, that's, again, I hate to say it, but that's what comedy writers should do. Mm-hmm. Comedy writers should be able to take all of this great real material that Anita and Ellen gave us, and then we figured out the comedy of it. But again, what made the comedy work was it was all built on this just incredibly real spine. And again, I think people who were in the know would go, wow, it's just like that. And if you're not in the know, it feels really real. So, you know, it works for everybody, civilians and professionals. And that's really what sort of our process was. And so for the first like month or two of almost every season, we really turned our writer's room into almost like a salon. You know, we would sometimes have two guests a day early on. And just from all aspects of politics, you know, reporters, candidates, staffers, just all aspects. And obviously, I mean, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, Tammy, because you help arrange so many of those people, but it all just went right into the stew. You know what I mean? It all just went right into the mixing pot. And again, it's that kind of stuff of like, you know, being able to be, you know, sort of hear about how library, you know, like presidential libraries work, just to go back to that idea, and to tour the library and hear the stories about how they acquire the stuff and all of these things. It's just incredible. And learning, you know, learning so much about like presidential funerals and all of that kind of stuff. And the notion that, you know, President Reagan and his wife are buried at their library led to this notion of Selena being buried at her library, which of course originally she doesn't like and makes her realize, you know, so all these things just play into the plot in just a wonderful way.
Well, I remember when we went to the Reagan Library and we walked out where President Reagan is buried and we talked about his funeral, and literally Veep, that those final scenes are, you know, with Gary, it's the same thing. It's so to just so you know, for all the special events producers who produce all the political coverage and things like that, people kept calling me, oh my God, how did they do that? It's so good.
Yeah, I mean, we really, you know, it's funny, we got a lot of mileage, obviously, out of the library in general. But number one was, even back when we were doing at the end of season six, when we were doing the groundbreaking of the library, which obviously doesn't happen at Yale University. I mean, I remember looking at pictures of like the Reagan groundbreaking. And, you know, again, we didn't like build it exactly the same, but it was like, oh, they wear hard hats. Oh, look, they have these like ceremonial shovels. And like, this is how the chairs are. And again, that's where our production design department, our prop people, all of that stuff are just so dead on, where we're working, you know, within this world of reality. But when it came to her funeral at the Vajaybury, I mean, not only we were looking at these other, you know, sort of famous burials, but I guess sadly at the same time, we had recently had the McCain funeral and the Bush funeral that obviously, you know, provided, you know, you hate to say reference points, but they did. They really did. You know, it gave us these models. And again, trying to maintain in our Veep world the sanctity of what a presidential, the seriousness, the sanctity, the straight of what a presidential funeral should be, even one for Selina Meyer, and then weaving the jokes in and around all of that sort of straight line. That's what makes it work. That's what makes Veep tick, I guess.
Basically. And that's what makes it so funny. Dave, I hadn't realized that your first foray into all of this was you were still a junior at Harvard, right? When you went to Comedy Central and did Indecision 92, which I was doing Larry King Live right next to you.
Oh, that's so funny. Indecision 92 was actually, I did a first thing at Comedy Central. Indecision 92 was the summer right after I graduated. Mm-hmm. It was Al Franken hosting basically for Comedy Central comedy coverage of the Democratic and Republican conventions. And Billy Kimball, one of the writers on my show, was the exec producer. Billy and Al hired me for my first job, and I brought Billy into Veep, you know, as, you know, the second I was offered it, he was probably one of my first calls. And I, you know, I was a gov major at Harvard, and, I'm into this stuff, and, you know, the convention stuff, it was almost like a telethon. We used to have to, you know, fill 3 hours a night, you know, and obviously not a lot of people wanted to talk to Comedy Central.
You were really looked at. People looked down their noses at you. Comedy people at such a serious event. We're news people. We're journalists.
Yeah, predating, you know, The Daily Show and all of this stuff. But boy, it was really fun. I mean, obviously, sometimes we did get people, but that was the year. I don't know if you remember this. Marilyn Quayle and her sister, this is the wife of the then Vice President Dan Quayle, they wrote a potboiler novel about a young congressman from Indiana, a la Dan Quayle, who helps like lead the Cuban Revolution. It was this crazy, crazy book. And we had a copy of the book. And whenever things got slow during the convention, Al would read aloud from the Marilyn Quayle, and I can't remember what her sister's name was, from that book. And then we kind of took it further. We would have him read to children from it. We did a puppet show. And then by the end, we actually enacted a scene, like the big climactic scene where everybody was dressed up as like different Cubans. And it was, you know, but like that's how we would, you know, quote unquote, fill time. It was very enjoyable.
I remember that book because I was working with Larry King. And he said he wanted to have sex with Marilyn Quayle. Do you remember that? And it was
hullabaloo. I remember. That's hilarious. Oh. I was very lucky enough. A couple of weeks ago, I was like Larry's first guest, I think, when he came back from
the heart. How's he doing? I hope to see him in a couple of weeks.
For one second you're like, oh wow, why is he even doing this? And then I got to tell you, he says hello and you start talking and it's like, oh man, this guy, boy, what a great, you know, just, this is one of the great interviewers of all time. And it was a pleasure. It was just I loved it. I was so happy because originally, and look, you know, they were like, oh, why don't you come on and we'll give you like one of the guest hosts. And it was like, no, that's okay. I'd rather, you know, if I'm going to do this, I want to wait for Larry King. I want Larry King. You know, it was, It was really great. It was really interesting.
You know, I've always felt that he never got his due as an interviewer. The fact that people believe that you had to read the book, that you had to know everything about it. There are many people who pretend to read the book and they don't get anything. But Larry always focused on the person. He always wanted to make them tell their story, give them the time to do it. And that, you know, that was the same year we found Ross Perot. He announced on the show, and it was such a big time. But I remember Al Franken doing that. And you should explain, I didn't realize there was a theme in your career, Dave. And that is, when you're in the office next to someone, I guess you were Comedy Central and Al was next door, you guys became friendly, and then he hired you. And then the same thing happened with Larry David, right? So we should advise future writers to get the right desk. Maybe that's a theme. I don't know.
Quite that. I mean, I got to work with these people, or I got to know them. You know, the way I got to know Larry, I mean, it's a very odd thing, is the two guys who I was longtime writing partners with, but also, good friends with, from as undergrads, and we were in the Lampoon together, Alec Berg and Jeff Schaefer. And Alec does Barry and Silicon Valley, and Jeff did The League, and we all did Curb, and we all did Seinfeld. They were a year older than me, so they graduated and moved out to LA, and I was a year behind, and I went to New York. But on my breaks from Saturday Night Live, I would go out to L.A. and I would just kind of hang out at the Seinfeld offices. So I think it really just was sort of like I was unoffensive, and I was a Yankee fan, and Larry hired me. So I guess
I feel like someone should be doing a documentary on you, Alec. That whole team of showrunners, the comedies you're doing are remarkable. I don't think it's something in the water. I think it's how you look at things and how you can write. I don't know how you do it, but I think that would be interesting. And especially now with this new kind of crazy culture that we're living in, the political world and media world, that maybe there's a lesson for all of us from the three of you.
The media stuff to me is real. I mean, you know, I do not want to watch that documentary, but, but I am truly fascinated by, you know, the media side of things these days right now, just watching, I guess, you know, now that I'm not doing Veep, but I'm still sort of, you know, what's the word? You know, I'm still reading what I would read every morning. I'm still sort of, I'm not necessarily thinking of Veep ideas, but you do become very aware of watching the Trump coverage and watching, you know, these various papers in their effort to not feel like people think that they're on one sided, but then they bend over backwards too far the other way. And boy, just wild times we are living.
Well, I mean, that is what's going on here. And, you know, the Trump outside advisors have come out and said that they're going to go after media. And I can tell you, covering 2016, when you're in a room, especially because I had my teenage daughter there, and they're just yelling at all media, you just wonder how this works out. I mean, what do you make of the fact, let's get into a little bit of a politics. What do you make of the fact that this disinformation campaign has been so effective? Brexit, the U.S., even now, every day, you name the politician or celebrity, and immediately there's bots. They're real people. They're fake people out there making all these comments. And the problem is the rest of the people look at it and think it's real. So the world is responding to, you know, to fake information.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm stunned by it. But I see it a little bit sometimes both ways, which is to say, in my occasional, you know, in my, like, I guess, whatever you want to call it, my quote unquote liberal friends on Facebook, you know, and these are people, you know, I guess for 3 seconds to go, you know, very well educated, very well read, whatever. But occasionally, you know, some crazy story just comes across Facebook and they're the first to forward it. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It works both sides. And so, you know, I never want to just go, oh, it's them and they're dumb and they don't have college degrees. I think maybe there is a difference, which is to say, when one of my sort of liberal friends finds out something is false, they are willing to accept the fact that they shouldn't have retweeted it or whatever, and that it is false and that they were wrong. Somehow that message is just not getting through on the other side. They're either content to be wrong or just don't believe. And it's I don't know what to say. As somebody with two children, it's just frightening. It's just frightening. And I do think, and I don't want to say this about college education because it's not to me about college education, but it does sometimes just speak to the fact that on both sides, people are often just way stupider than I would like them to be. I don't know what else to say. And I'm not talking about college education. I'm just talking about you have to read. You have to check things out for yourself. And, you know, obviously the social media and whatnot's not making it any easier. And you see these things like, I don't know, the other day, YouTube announced that this last month, they got rid of, I don't know, like 170,000, like, white supremacist like videos and accounts, and they were kind of announcing it like we should be applauded for getting rid of it. And it's like, applauded for getting rid of 170,000 accounts. Let's see, in no particular order, number one, how many did you miss? Number two, why are there 170,000 white supremacist videos to begin with? How did we get to that? And so this is the problem, you know? Their business model is not taking accounts down. And I'm not just picking on YouTube. Pick on any of them. You know, Facebook continually makes up these rules that are both easy to flout and unenforceable. And it's just more of the same. And, you know, I think especially this year, you're just going to see more and more and more. I mean, I guess you and I won't see it, but the targeted Facebook stuff, you know, it's the same way Brexit happened. All these targeted things, oh, we're coming for your guns, we're coming for your guns, we're coming for your guns. I'm nervous and I'm scared. I don't know what else to say.
I remember during the 2016 election and it went around Facebook, Hillary is a lizard. And we all, Hillary Clinton is a lizard. And I remember we all kind of laughed about it. How ridiculous, right? I mean, that had taken it to the most extreme degree. But now none of the ridiculous things aren't funny anymore because they get inside your head. And if you think it's bad today with the kind of super micro targeting that's now available, I agree with you. I'm frightened about it. All right, let's talk about.
I was just saying one thing. There's a famous quote, and I'm sure I'm going to mangle it, which is, generals are always trying to fight the last war and they're unprepared for the next war. I think even with all the stuff we know about, I don't think anyone is prepared for like probably what they've come up with for this next round of stuff. And that's where it really just gets frightening. And now, you know, again, I will now make it political, which is to say, clearly, you know, Mitch McConnell and the Republicans don't care. They do not care. They are happy to have those advantages. They are, you know, happy, they, you know, not to pass, you know, election security laws. I mean, I am baffled that this is where we are in our country. Even in the UK this week, a couple of, you know, the reason they're having some of their troubles this week is at least some of the people in Boris Johnson's own party stood up to him. I'd love to see something like that happen in the United States of America.
Well, I think, well, you know why they're not going to. It's just not going to happen right now. Sure. But you know, it's all about votes. And the thing that's interesting the last couple weeks is how many people have been willing to talk about after Trump, whether that's, you know, 2 more years or 4 years. But that conversation has already started. And I think people are just saying it because it makes them feel better. And the truth is, people don't really, you know, I just came back from the Iowa State Fair and they're pretty savvy in Iowa, especially if you're at the state fair, all the candidates are coming through. And most of the people aren't paying attention. And I think that's the biggest issue as a longtime political producer. People don't pay attention until the fall. And I know we're just getting into the fall, but in January. And but the question now is, with all this extra noise around, are you going to wade through it all to find out what's really important or to get some answers that you really want? We'll have to see. Okay, we have to turn to Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Can you talk about when you first met?
Well, I first met her, you know, when I was a Seinfeld writer. I started at Seinfeld in May of 95, the third to last season, which was ended up being Larry David's last season. And, you know, we were... I would never pretend like we were best friends. You know, I think in general, the cast had a really nice relationship with all of the writers. But, you know, for some reason, even though she and I are not, you know, actually that far apart age-wise, back then when I was sort of 25 and she was a mother of two, it seemed very different. Do you know what I mean?
Right, like, sure.
She seemed like an adult. And I think a lot of us writers seemed like kids, you know what I mean, in some weird, funny way. But obviously, I mean, you know, the thing about Seinfeld and her and all of those guys was, even at a young age for me as a writer, you know, you have the writer's ego, that the way you're sort of writing it and the way it is in your head is the best way it can ever be. And that cast, and her especially, the way she would kind of, you know, twist her lines, you know, things that now I'm very used to. But even then as a fan, I was just always shocked, you know, by the words she would stress or how she would, like, elongate a syllable or a sound or something and just do it differently than I ever imagined. And yet at the same time, of course, do it even funnier. And I'm not afraid to say this. I think speaking for all the writers at the time, we all sort of had like comedy crushes on her. You know what I mean? Because she was obviously, you know, a beautiful, you know, beautiful woman, but also just so damn hilarious. And for a long time for me in sort of other work, you know, she was the gold standard. I mean, I remember Jeff Alec and I made the movie, a teen comedy called Eurotrip, which, If you were like a 14-year-old, you remember it well, because there was a lot of boobs in it. So Michelle Trachtenberg played the girl, and we had a couple of scenes where, I mean, for lack of a better word, our directing note. And by the way, we were terrible directors.
You
at the
directed
time.
It too?
Yeah, we co-directed it. Jeff got the credit, but the three of us wrote it and directed it. But a lot of our sort of like what we were sort of telling Michelle to do was basically do Julia. Like, this is what Julia would do. And that's what we kind of did. We taught her to do a couple of, like, again, we're talking a little, some comedy scenes of like, this is how Julia would do it. That she was the gold standard for us.
And is that because... I found her to be so careful and thoughtful about everything she did. I mean, on camera and off, like, really thought through how it ends up. I don't know if you agree, and is that typical?
It's certainly true. I guess that's not, I think, what we were responding to. I think it was just that mix of, you know, on the one hand, if you sort of saw her, you know, and she, you know, and she wasn't speaking or whatever, you just, you know, you're like, oh, look at that, you know, look at that cute girl. You know what I mean? Like, right. That's that. And then when the mouth opens, the willingness to sort of make an ass of herself, to be sort of unlikable, but, you know, in that package, you're just sort of stunned and hilarious. And obviously timing and all of those other things. And so I think that's what we were kind of playing with, which was, you know, Michelle was the cute girl in our thing. But, you know, there was a scene where she's sort of, I don't know, flirting with a guy, but then has to turn around and scream at her friends behind her. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a very sort of I don't know, like comedy 101, but it was very Julia, very Elaine. Anyway, I don't know. You know, Veep is a whole different thing, which is, you know, when we started getting together to talk about this thing, and I don't want to speak for her, but obviously I know she was nervous about continuing the show without Armando. She knew me, but she didn't know me. And we started these sort of conversations, these sort of marathon sessions where we, you know, I was a fan of the show, but I started, you know, talking to her about where I thought it would go. And then she would add stuff on top of mine and I would add stuff on top of her. And it was this wonderful thing of like always knowing that we were in tune, you know, like that we, you know, I found her funny. I think she found me funny. But all of a sudden we were just so simpatico about the show, the characters, where it could go. You know, we had these sort of like, as I said, session after session after session. And we really kind of came out of it as, you know, like partners. It was really just kind of wonderful. And it wasn't that I was unexpecting it, but it was even more than I ever imagined it would be. You know, and I think we have the same, I guess, just insane work ethic. And, you know, we just value comedy above all else. And we're sort of willing, I hate to say, sort of like, you know, make everyone else crazy to achieve what we want comedy-wise.
Well, you didn't make anyone else crazy, but I found it fascinating when I was on the set how collaborative you were, and how and also the other writers too. It was like this really small unit. It was if you guys were, you know, and in a, you know, in Normandy and you know, somewhere on one of those boats together. You know, I always look at those videos and think, oh my God, what, you know, what are those relationships that you were, and you were going to do whatever you can to win, to survive, to lead.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, going back to when I put the my writing staff together, because the show had been made in Baltimore by an all British staff, and a couple of the Brits stuck around, but I put a new staff together, and a lot of the staff, and again, I think some of it in my mind at the time was that I knew we were, you know, we were jumping in on season five. There wasn't going to be a lot of room for mistakes. You know what I mean? People are going to be judging us and all these things. And so it wasn't to me like putting a staff together if I was making a pilot, where it was sort of like, we're going to figure out what the show is. We're going to all get to know each other. I definitely was aware that, yeah, we were going to be sort of thrown into the bunker. And so a lot of the people were people that I've had, you know, work experiences with sort of outside of Veep. Most of the staff were people I knew and knew well. And that was something. And it expanded a little bit over time. But even over time, most of the people that I did add were people that I had worked with somewhere or had been sort of someone that I trusted more than life itself really recommended. And HBO was really always wonderful about allowing the writers to like sort of stick around and stay through all of production and stuff. And so I had this just amazing team just constantly sort of handing me stuff, for lack of a better word, allowing me to do my thing on top of it, plus this incredible cast that could ad-lib, throw stuff in. And it was this sort of combo of that. And again, I think just our insane desire to like leave no stone unturned, leave no space unfilled by a joke, and not worry. And this is another thing too that I think the show always did, but again, Julia and I think are very simpatico on, which is, we're not going to waste time explaining things. We're not going to insult the audience. We're going to move. We're going to do stuff, and they'll figure it out. We're not going to worry if they don't know that Clyde Tolson was you know, J. Edgar Hoover's lover. They'll figure it out. Someone will know, someone won't know. It'll fly by. You can look it up later, but we're not going to waste time talking down to you. We're going to just do the thing that we want to do, and we hope you like it. And I think, again, we just kind of, we were just really eye to eye on a lot of this stuff.
And you're going to stay with HBO. Why didn't you go to Netflix or Hulu?
Very enjoyed my HBO has, you know, both my time at Curb Your Enthusiasm and now Veep. They take good care of me, and they put up with me. So there you go.
Do you have any special projects in mind?
You know, it's funny. I you know, we're talking now in early September, and you know, Veep, you know, finished. And then obviously there was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of media and press stuff and whatever. So I took a little break to just, you know, recharge the batteries, and they were good enough to allow me that time. So I've, you know, just been starting to you know, write some areas down and play with some stuff and pick up some books and read some articles and things. So I'm just sort of, you're catching me just as I'm kind of getting back into the swing of things.
Ooh, so now's the time for me to pitch my show to you, right?
Yes, exactly.
Is there one idea or one, I mean, you've talked a lot about how you do the jokes and how you worked with Julia, but is there one idea that stuck with you, you know, the last 20 years that you keep revisiting either in style or substance, or as you look at future shows, something that you want to make sure that's in there?
I mean, I think it's that same thing, which is, you know, when I did Seinfeld and then obviously, and then into Curb, the best episodes of those shows, the best episodes that I wrote, the best episodes that other people wrote, were things that kind of, I guess, most of the time came out of my own life, that there was a reality to the stories. And then obviously we took them to crazy places. And that's where you, I think you can see the similarity with Veep. So we were talking about before, the reality of talking to, you know, a staffer who tells us stories about a fun, you know, something that happened to their boss. And then we do a version of that in Veep, like landing at the wrong airport. And so I guess, you know, I know that's not really an answer to your question, but I that's how I will continue to work, which is whether it's mining my own life or mining the reality of some subject matter. But again, I want that. That sort of, I guess I'll simply say, reality-based thing sort of as at the root of it, whether it's as a, you know, person or job or whatever it is. So that's just like that's the way I was taught to do it, for lack of a better word.
When I first started watching Curb Your Enthusiasm, all I could think of is, oh my God, Larry David is Bernie Sanders. And now when I watch Bernie Sanders campaigning, all I think of is, oh my God, Bernie Sanders is doing Larry David. Do you ever look at Bernie Sanders and feel like, oh my God, I'm back in Curb Your Enthusiasm?
You know, obviously there are those times. I will say this, and boy, now we're going to get into some now things that are going to whatever.
Sometimes, oh, good.
I thought, you know, obviously Larry has his way and, you know, he says his things. But they do often come from, I guess, the character of Larry David, which is different than the person Larry David. The character always sort of in his own weird way either thinks he's fighting against some hypocrisy or he's trying to help in his own twisted way. And real life Larry David, I think, often thinks of these things but doesn't actually say them. Mm-hmm. And I am now, and then here's the thing that's going to upset a lot of people. Sometimes when I watch Bernie Sanders and he's, you know, sort of particularly, I guess what people think sometimes is him sort of being very like Larry-like, I sometimes see a little bit of a meanness that I don't love. And so there you go. People are going to get all up in arms. But I think there's a difference there. I notice it having not worked with Bernie Sanders, but having worked a lot with Larry David. I think obviously there's an easy impression that you can both, that they can sort of do of each other. But I don't know. I don't know. There's something, the Bernie thing, there's something for me that's, I don't know, a little mean sometimes. I'm sorry.
Okay. Since Veep is over, you can talk a little bit more about politics. When you look at the Democratic presidential candidates, I'm not going to ask who you're for, but as a media person, who do you think has the opportunity to get a larger audience or possibly get the nomination?
I have no idea where anything is going, and even if you asked me who I like, I would still probably give you a list. But I have to admit, I have been really impressed by, I think, how much better Elizabeth Warren has gotten with the media, with not falling into the sort of the traps that are being sort of put out there for her, for coming off a little bit more genuine than she sort of did for me a couple of years ago. And so I'm impressed by that, I'll tell you that.
Mm-hmm. And what about Mayor Pete?
I like him a lot. I do sometimes worry about Mayor, I have to leave it at that. That being said, I like him a lot.
Yes, the mayor is another thing, but I work with Mike Bloomberg, so I think mayors can do anything. All right, I have one final question.
But that's a mayor that sort of took a step down to be mayor. That right. Bloomberg doesn't quite count, so yeah.
Do you think, by the way, that another candidate might pop in? People still think Mike Bloomberg might come in. John Kerry's waiting in the wings. Who else have we heard about?
I would be very surprised in this day and age of, I don't see somebody popping out. I don't see somebody coming out of a convention. I guess, I don't know. I could be wrong. We used the lovely Mayor Bloomberg, who I am a personal fan of, especially his work again for gun safety. And by the way, forget gun safety, his work to get just guns gone. That's what I love, that his attack on the climate crisis. I am a fan of Mayor Bloomberg, former Mayor Bloomberg. We actually had him on Curb Your Enthusiasm. He's not great in front of the camera, and that will forever be his, I think, Achilles heel, unfortunately.
All right. Will you do another show about politics?
I think politics will always be a part of something, but I think it will come in more sideways. I do not imagine certainly the next thing I do will not be set in DC. It will not be about someone who's elected for office, but it's something I will always talk about in whatever I do, I think.
Well, what about this? How would you feel about writing for a candidate? Helping these candidates could use some good jokes, right?
I would love to. And then over the years, I mean, I don't think I'm saying anything that I'm not supposed to. I can't tell you the number of times over the years, especially in these last couple of years, I've been on these sort of like, you know, email chains with like a candidate, you know, not with a candidate, but somebody who works for the candidate, like, you know, they're looking for some jokes for something. And then really good comedy writers pitch really, really funny jokes. And they're, I guess for lack of a better word, the jokes are, they're too funny for them. I mean, both in terms of a lot of them, either their delivery or, oh, someone on their team goes, well, that seems a little mean towards this and whatever. And it's just, it's never going to work. I mean, I'll keep, anyone that asks me, I'll happily send. But my experience is that their politicians are just too wary of real jokes.
Well, and I can do the other side. The comedians that come in for the White House Correspondents' Dinner, they never get that room. You know, I mean, there's some of the biggest comedians. What's the story?
I think that's lately. I mean, you know, just to, I guess, you know, I used to help, you know, this is now years ago. I used to help before he was ever a senator, before anything. I helped Al when he did the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And we used to have just a blast and a half. I remember one thing, we used to do these jokes about like, welcome to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And we would go like, if you're listening on the radio, as if anyone would be listening to the White House Correspondents' Dinner on the radio. And then he would like make up people at tables, and it would be like Mike Espy is sitting next to the president of Tyson Chicken. And we would just make stuff up. It was very, you know, in the room jokes kind of a thing. And so I think it's very doable. You just have to be willing to do it, you know?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, Dave, it's so great to be with you today as someone who began his career writing about politics. And now here you are with the top political comedy. It's always a joy to be with you.
Anything for you, Tammy. You know that.
Thanks, my friend.
Bye-bye.
I'm Tammy Haddad. Thank you for listening to Cone of Silence.